we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Harvey Rich, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Today, we're continuing our new weekly series where various smart and interesting people ask me questions, mostly on things scientific, but who knows where our conversations go. And if listeners have questions for me, please submit them at americaoutloud.com/pulse, P-U-L-S-E. I'm pleased to introduce today's interviewer, Dr. Howard Tenenbaum, who is professor of periodontology in the Faculty of Dentistry and professor in the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathophysiology in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto in Ontario, Canada. Dr. Tenenbaum's professional expertise includes the physiology of what happens in the mouth and nose and their cells and the immune system when the virus first enters the body. So Howard, let's start. What's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, thanks for giving me this honor of interviewing you. I'm sure it's going to be very interesting. There's a few things on my mind. One thing I think that comes up, it's relatively recent. It's the issue concerning what's going on in China, mainland China, that relates to the current epidemic of, I suppose, Omicron. Supposedly, the Chinese population is suffering greatly since they got rid of their zero COVID lockdown policy. And we're seeing news reports of funeral centers being overcrowded. These are noticed by satellite imagery and things like this. And it kind of reminds me of what we saw at the beginning of the COVID epidemic or pandemic, when we saw videos of people dying in the streets and so on. And so what do you think is really going on there? Are they really experiencing a massive uptick in disease?
Well, I think that they are seeing larger number of cases than we had seen in our comparable period of the variants in question, the Omicron variants, when we got to them some months ago. So they're seeing things that we've already gone through. They're seeing BF7, and I forget the other one that's in their circulation. Those were Omicron. They were mild infections here in the US, but China's a different context because they've locked down for so long that they've kind of desensitized their immune systems. When you're locked down, you don't come in contact with lots of new people with new trivial viruses, cold viruses, and so on, that keeps your immune system, what you might say, topped up, ready to spring into action. And doing that for a few years really kind of dumbs down the immune system. Whereas here in the US, we had no extended lockdowns for most people. And so people were constantly being exposed to viruses and fighting them off. And so by the time Omicron hit, most people were well prepared to deal with it. Either they had been recently vaccinated, or they had had COVID, or they had challenged immune systems that are able to respond. And so most people just took this in stride as a virus similar to the common cold in many respects, or to a flu kind of illness. Whereas in China, I think they've had a more of a struggle because the population has had less immune challenge during all the times of their lockdowns. I don't think it's going to be major even there, but I think that explains why there's more cases and the cases seem to be a little severe for Omicron that we took in stride.
So you think that the satellite imagery that you see on CNN, or you hear about at least on CNN or some other news stations, where there's lineups at funeral homes or cremation centers, is again some gaslighting, or perhaps because of the huge population that China has, that even if it is a small percentage, it's still a large number of people could actually be dying, or are we once again being perhaps misled in that regard?
I think there's no way to know that. It's even hard to know the accuracy of the statistics that are presented in public, the case counts, the mortality, the hospitalizations. Don't forget, in China, in their culture, the first line of treatment for anything is go to the hospital. They don't have the kind of outpatient acute care setups that have evolved in the last 30 years. And it's still their culture to race to the emergency room for the sniffles, so to speak. And so the hospital utilization information is differently interpreted, I would say, for them compared to us, even if we had accurate information, which we don't know that we do. And as to the mortality information, they undoubtedly have had some mortality, but it's hard to know the accuracy of it. And it's really hard to base quantitative counts on photographic images of one place being crowded or another at any given time.
Right. And we're dealing with a virus that supposedly has even the original strain had a very low infection fatality rate, really comparable to flu, annual flu, although that's not what we heard all the time. One would anticipate that the Omicron variants that they're experiencing should have a lower, infection fatality rate, but maybe there are other issues that they're facing in China, nutritional issues, other issues, vitamin D, that you could talk about that also might impact on their ability to fight this otherwise mild virus.
Well, I think that's a very good point. The vitamin D is levels tend to be lower, I understand, in China on average, and there's much less of a move for supplementation of vitamin D and other vitamins in normal people's daily lives for the most part, except for maybe small numbers of elite sort of westernized people. And so we know that low vitamin D levels predispose to doing much more poorly with this virus and in terms of survivability of it in people who have chronic conditions and other reasons why they might get hospitalized. So vitamin D supplementation is something that's so cheap and easily available and so non-toxic that it's a universal recommendation that we've been making throughout the pandemic, and it applies to China as well. So it's likely. The other thing is that China is a very large country geographically and has very different climates in the north versus the south. And so the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables is very latitude gradient. And so there's a lot more in southern China than there is in northern China. And so the dietary adequacy may vary. And it would be interesting to look at different parts of China to see whether the statistics change by latitude.
I guess also socioeconomic strata are important. I mean, we know in North America or throughout the world that people in the lower levels of socioeconomic well-being tend not to do well with various diseases, not just COVID. China certainly has a wide disparity, I would imagine, in that regard.
I think that's right. And I think that it's difficult to pin down the exact health-related behaviors that associate with socioeconomic status. So certainly, better diets cost more, by and large, that there's got to be a gradient in that. But there ought to be at least sufficient diets that are not that expensive that mostly everybody can do if they had education. But education is also highly structured along socioeconomic class lines. And so uneducated people are less likely to know that diets should be anything different than what they've been doing for multiple generations anyway. In poor neighborhoods out in small villages and who knows where, the poverty is in China, if not in the big cities. So I think that this does, social class does play a role in this. But the flip side of that, of course, is the maladies of too high of a socioeconomic status, meaning obesity and chronic conditions that don't, aren't so prevalent in poor people, but we in the West have moved into that problem, especially in the United States, Germany, other Western countries. So It's not all rosy one way or the other, I guess.
Yeah. So one of the other, I think, issues is we wonder about early outpatient care, you know, which has been vilified in some states and in India and one state, Uttar Pradesh, it's used and successfully so. Do you know at all what is the status of early repurposed multi-drug therapy, for example, using hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, doxycycline, azithromycin cocktails? Is that at all used in China, or is that also frowned upon there?
Well, it was used. I have a document that was put out by the National Ministry of Health in Chinese from March of 2020. And in it, it says explicitly to use chloroquine, which is the other version of hydroxychloroquine, also works perfectly well for treating early outpatient COVID. And so it says to use that, gives a recipe for the dosage and how long and so on, along with all the other things. Now, it happens that the document misspelled the word chloroquine in Chinese, but it's very clear from the dosing that chloroquine is what they meant. And I've pointed this out to some Chinese correspondents who laughed that I figured this out and they haven't. But
I didn't realize you could read Chinese. That's actually a...
No, actually, you just use Google Translate works very well.
Oh.
And when you look at the actual characters in the words, you can see how the strokes got misinterpreted for the character that was used in the document versus what the one for chloroquine actually is.
It's funny you should use the word stroke, because I was going to ask if there are any differences between the vaccine used in China. So I think it's called Sinovac. Principally, versus, let's say, the mRNA vaccines used here that seem to be associated with blood clots and other sorts of problems like myocarditis. What are the similarities, differences? You hear on the news, oh, one of the reasons for problems in China is they didn't get to use the much better vaccines that we have here in North America.
Well, I don't know that much about the Sinovac. It's not an mRNA-based vaccine, as far as I understand. And I think only about a half or 60% of the population has even gotten one dose of it. So there was either a lot more vaccine skepticism, or people just couldn't get it, or they couldn't afford it, or the country didn't provide it, or, you know, whatever the reasons were, that there was not as much uptake there as here. But I don't think that really matters as much in terms of the long-term behavior. You have to remember that these viruses get into the population, and then how long they stay, how much of the population they affect, whether they go away or stay endemic, is all a balance between the aggressiveness, the transmissibility of the virus, and the geographic and receptiveness of the population. That if people live in congested housing, that a virus is much more easily transmitted between them. And so it doesn't matter what numbers of viruses get in at the beginning, that all it takes is two or three people infected with the virus, and in all likelihood, it will expand and grow exponentially. And that's what respiratory viruses do. So this is the reason why locking out travelers is completely useless for preventing infections in a country, because people are already in there that you haven't figured out, that you haven't found. And so they will release the virus unknowingly, regardless of anything you do. And, you know, unless you get absolutely everyone that's possible, and by the time you do these travel interruptions, people have already gotten in, so it's always too late. So and it doesn't matter whether one person brings it in or 10 or 1,000. All that does is determine when the epidemic occurs. But the epidemic itself is a negotiation, a balance between the organism and the population and the circumstances.
So regardless of the virus getting in or not, we also, people worry, oh my goodness, it's a different variant. Well, that variant or those variants are here already anyway. So not only, I guess, does it not matter, you know, when the virus gets in, but even when we talk about the variants, I mean, aren't they already here?
They've been and gone by and large. The Chinese strains, substrains, they're all, they're, everything now is Omicron. Omicron is the strain. So all of these things are substrains. They're variants that branched off of Omicron, which had its own branching history up to when it occurred. And so these substrains all occurred in the middle to late last year. And we are two generations past those. I think there's still, the CDC says that there's a teeny bit of BF7 still left. But then we had BQ1 and BQ1.1, which are still highly in the US circulation, and XBB, and then XBB1 and XBB1.5 that are the major ones now. And so the XBBs are one generation past the BQs, which are a generation past the BA5, which is a generation past the BF7. And you get the idea that these things happen over and over and over again, that as the virus evolves, they acquire new properties, and vaccination directed at the older ones becomes more and more useless as the virus escapes from the immunity provided by those vaccines.
You can only imagine what would happen if the during the news cycle they focused on different strains of the influenza virus the same way they're doing on with COVID. You'd never have time for any other news.
Well, true, but we haven't had time for any other news except, here in the US, except for, the top secret papers that seem to be found in presidential homes. But other than
Yeah.
that,
Well, the location of the papers keeps mutating, from what
that's
I
right.
understand,
Well,
as well as the information related there too. Something
let me interrupt. We're getting
Oh,
close to our commercial break time, so we're going to
okay.
take a break, and then we'll be back shortly. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
We know you love the versatility and portability of the Genesis Fogger, but sometimes you just want to set it and forget it. Well, we heard you. Introducing the UX4 HOCL Atomizer. This stationary unit quietly protects you and is perfect for smaller spaces. With over 250,000 units sold in Japan, it's now available in the United States. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to see the UX4 in action and receive a 15% discount on either Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep is infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's fast-paced digital age makes it tougher. You're not alone. Poor sleep affects over 70% of us. The CDC even labeled insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created REM Sleep to help you quickly fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake refreshed. Unlike other supplements that don't work, REM Sleep is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients, supporting all four stages of sleep using calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Over 1,000 reviews with an average star rating of over 4.4 proves it works. Take back your sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
For 40 years, alarmists have been warning of a climate catastrophe, yet none of their dire predictions have come true. Temperatures have not soared. Sea level rise has not been unusual. And extreme weather events have not increased in either frequency or intensity. In short, there is no climate emergency. For 15 years, the International Climate Science Coalition has led the call for climate realism and a Made in America climate plan, a plan based on real science that responds to the real world needs of Americans, supports economic growth, and strengthens our essential infrastructure. A plan that protects the environment and ensures that Americans can enjoy the blessings of clean air, clean land, and clean water for generations to come. It's time to put ideology and pseudoscience aside. It's time for a sensible climate plan. For more information or to donate, visit our website, icsc-climate.com.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Dr. Howard Hennenbaum. We were just discussing going on a commercial break. Well, actually, we were discussing the location of presidential papers and how that keeps mutating as much as the virus does.
Yes, and I think it may actually be pushed by the vaccine mandate, the actual location of the papers. Maybe we'll find out where the 6-foot distancing rule came from in some of the documents.
But I don't think either of them are going to have immunity.
That's right, or at least not long-lasting.
Right.
A couple of other questions. You know, we were talking about the testing of passengers. They're talking about it in Canada, too, and it seems to be very wrong-headed, just based on what you said. But the other issue, of course, relates to the use of the test itself, the PCR test. It's a legitimate test. It's a very sensitive test. But there are some very significant problems related, to the interpretation of the results that we derive from the test and how we then act upon those results, both in the past, but even now, and also with this proposed testing of people coming from China. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Sure. Well, you see all sorts of opinions about the PCR testing, including that it's not real, that it's all that it's fake, or that it's definitive. And all of them have seeds of truth because the test itself is variable and does various things. So the basic idea of the test is that little bits of genetic information in real life, in cells, get reproduced by taking the genetic code and an enzyme making a copy, and then the enzyme taking the two copies and making two more copies to get four, and then making copies of the four to get eight. And this process keeps occurring in cycles until you get millions to billions of copies over time. It's done in cycles. And in the process of doing this, the cycling is controlled by heat, by temperature, so that you do one cycle of, you make it warm, and then the enzyme works, and then you cool it down to stop it and complete the replication of one complete string of the genetic material. And then you repeat this in cycles. Well, at some point, if there really is the right genetic material to start with, you'll get a signal that you can read macroscopically. Remember, the genetic information is microscopic, but the genetic testing, the PCR, adds a marker to it, like a fluorescent marker that can be read from the sample that's being processed. And so that's what the testing does. It amplifies the genetic material through cycles, and it measures when the fluorescent signal occurs, if it occurs, as to how many cycles it took. So if it takes 10 cycles until the fluorescent marker is observed, that means there was so much genetic material at the beginning that the test was easily able to discover it in replicating it only 10 times, which is like a thousandfold. On the other hand, if it takes 20 cycles before the signal is measured, then that means it's replicated 20 times or a million fold. And that means the original concentration was much lower because it took many more cycles to be registered. And similarly, if it takes 30 or 40 cycles, the greater the cycle number to register, the more likely it is that there's a smaller and smaller amount of original genetic material. Now, the problem is that genetic material in the nose can stay around for a long period of time because it gets broken up into fragments. And the fragments themselves can test positive in this genetic testing system because, you know, this virus, it has a genetic code of about 30,000 letters. But the PCR testing only needs 20 or 30 letters in a string intact in order to recognize it. And because of that, fragments of the virus can also test positive. But you have to realize that fragments of the virus stay around when the virus is long gone. And so what this means is that people who test positive at high cycle numbers probably had the virus, but long in the past. They've gotten over it. They're no longer infective, but they're still testing positive because of these fragments that are remaining in the nose or in the saliva. And so the problem has been, where do you set the threshold for the number of cycles? to find that a person is actively infectious, meaning if you get coughed on by them or breathe their air or whatever, that you'll get the live virus that will infect you too. And this is not well established. It's clear that at level cycles of up to about 24 or 25, that most of the tests that are positive at that level will be of people who are currently infectious and can transmit the virus. When you get to cycles of over 30, over 33, most of those will not be infectious. Those will be people who had the virus, maybe asymptomatically, 3, 4, 6 weeks in the past. So the problem is trying to figure out the difference. When the commercial laboratories all set their testing threshold for positivity at 40 cycles, then anybody who's even looked at the virus on TV might test positive. In other words, it's so sensitive, the test is so sensitive that it'll pick up almost everything. And you don't want to be testing at that level. And nevertheless, the laboratories all over the world use different cycle thresholds, different numbers of cycles to determine positivity or not. And so that's why the test has been vague and why people who are asymptomatic, who never developed symptomatic COVID, have tested positive, and it's not that unusual because most likely they had already had COVID asymptomatically a few weeks earlier, didn't know they had it, or they had might have had mild sniffles and a light cold, and that was all they had. And now they're still testing positive in a test that's not very good for determining the difference between active infection and old, even broken up pieces of genetic material from an older infection. And so that's the problem with the test. People have also said that the PCR tests positive for flu. It is not true. The PCR does not test positive for flu. However, if somebody tests negative on the PCR test, it means that they are unlikely to have had COVID either now or in the recent past. And that's probably a reasonable conclusion, given that they had an adequate sample taken from their nose at a time when the virus was highly replicating. And that doesn't occur until a few days into the infection. So people who are tested at the first sign of a scratchy throat, for example, or a headache or muscle aches, may not test positive yet, but 2 days later, they'll test positive. And that's just inherent with the amount of virus that's in the nose available to be scraped out on a swab and put into the testing apparatus. So it takes a little time for the virus to replicate, to be test positive.
And I wonder, when it comes down to it, how important it is that we determine whether somebody is ill from COVID respiratory illness versus another severe, if it's an elderly person or something like this, especially since we have early interventional therapy. I mean, it's almost the type of thing where you would start treatment first and ask questions later, regardless of what the test shows.
Absolutely. You start treatment first. Use everything, you know, if a person is fragile, elderly, has chronic cardiovascular disease, is immunocompromised, has had cancer, chronic kidney disease, obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, all of these things that predispose to doing poorly with COVID infection, even possibly Omicron infection, you want to get to them ASAP. And in fact, a colleague of mine, Dr. George Farid in San Diego area, was early in the pandemic treating nursing home patients with hydroxychloroquine. And the way he would there, since they are very medically fragile, you have to get to them ASAP. And he was having the facility test their temperature 3 times a day and testing their fingertip oxygen saturation levels, I think, twice a day. And when anybody changed in the slightest from where they had been at the same time of day the previous day, he started treating them. These people did not know they had the infection. They had no idea that anything was going on. But it was a very sensitive method. And given that these treatments are so innocuous, that hydroxychloroquine is such a safe and innocuous medication, that it's the first thing you do. And then if it turns out they don't have COVID and they don't have another respiratory disease and you didn't really need to treat them, well, you're out 80 cents or $1.20 or $2, whatever it costs you for the pills.
Right. And that really speaks of the focused protection, I think, that was the Jay Bhattacharya et al. Were really talking about, to focus on the elderly and protect them properly. I don't know if he was thinking of using hydroxychloroquine at the time, but this seems to be the important issue. I think something comes up about the PCR. You mentioned the term asymptomatic testing, and I wonder how you feel about this. I don't use the word asymptomatic testing. I think it was chosen actually on purpose as part of, again, this fear campaign. Asymptomatic testing. We used to call that testing of healthy people. And by using that word, you automatically switch. It's like a frame shift, from testing people who are healthy. And ordinarily, why would you do that? To, oh no, we're testing asymptomatic people, implying that there is asymptomatic, everyone's sick, they just don't know it.
Right. It implies that it's a normative fact that there's a large proportion of people who actually have COVID out in the population and are not symptomatic with it. That you'd actually find, if, in other words, if one in 100,000 people with COVID, you know, does not have symptoms but actually has COVID, then testing 100,000 people to find that one is ridiculous. Right.
Right.
But if 30,000 out of that 100,000 have COVID and are, you know, are not symptomatic, then that would be a common thing. And then there's a reason to test. So the idea that you would do asymptomatic testing is the implication that it's common to find people who test positive who actually have COVID and don't know it. And that, you're right, was an unstated assumption that added to the fear propaganda.
Yeah.
It is true that such people do exist. People have had COVID in the most minor, mild ways at times. And, you know, so there's reason to think that some people will test positive that way and could be infectious, but it's a very, very small fraction. As far as my understanding is, it's a very small fraction of people. People become symptomatic. And the other thing you mentioned before was that people with other respiratory viruses, starting to treat them with a COVID regimen that we know works for COVID. Well, so if we're using it for RSV in adolescents, say, or for flu, we don't quite know yet whether these things will work. The zinc seems to be common to all of those respiratory infections that it will work, and hydroxychloroquine at the least will help to get the zinc into the cells so the zinc can function properly. And so it's entirely likely that these regimens will also work for other respiratory illnesses. We just haven't done widespread treating or testing to know that yet, but I think there's reason to be optimistic because of the mechanisms involved.
A bit of a silver lining to the COVID cloud is, in my opinion, is that we may have discovered some therapies for respiratory viruses that we were ignoring before. I mean, there are cell culture studies showing that some of the agents that we've been focusing on for SARS-CoV-2 are effective for RSV, for various influenza viruses, and so on. So, and one of the other issues is that when we treat these things, we're treating the patient more than the virus itself. We're modifying the patient's response and machinery. And so I have a feeling that you're very right about that, as you are about most things. One other question, unless we are running out of time, comes to the vaccine issue, vaccinated versus, I call them non-vaccinated. I don't like to use the word unvaccinated. As you know, I think there are probably a billion people right now who'd like to get unvaccinated. the PCR data, especially with the cycling data, maybe you can discuss that. So some people may not understand that when they use cycle data, cycle threshold data, they're showing that vaccinated individuals actually seem to show up positive with lower cycle thresholds. And what does that mean?
That's not something I've studied, so I really don't know. It doesn't surprise me. There's a number of studies now that show that people with COVID who've been vaccinated have about the same levels of the virus in their nose as unvaccinated people. So the vaccines are not doing much in terms of infectivity transmission in people who've got the virus compared to non-vaccinated people.
Right. So with regard to prevention, if we get too efficient at preventing viral infection, then maybe our immune systems will start to go to sleep. Maybe that's part of our, you know, 100 million years of evolution, with, you know, in concert with the development of these constantly mutating mRNA viruses that are always tweaking our immune system. Nevertheless, what sort of preventive approaches would you talk about? I mean, like you mentioned vitamin D, would it be vitamin D alone, or are there compounds that one should take with vitamin D specifically as regards vitamin D metabolism, and maybe other things that people could do to protect themselves if they're worried about exposing themselves in a situation where they might develop an infection?
Well, my proclivity, my choice is to take vitamin D and zinc and some vitamin C, not a large amount. And because I've had muscle cramps in the winter from taking zinc, I also take magnesium, which seems to help with that. I think that none of these things are that important except for the vitamin D. The vitamin D has been studied in major ways, and there's very strong evidence for increasing mortality in respiratory infections as a function of too low vitamin D. And people can even have their vitamin D levels measured to be sure, you know, it's not an emergency, but next time you get a physical exam, your annual physical exam with lab tests from your doctor, to see if you can get vitamin D listed on the schedule of things to test, just to be sure you're in the right range. You don't have to make vitamin D as high as possible. It's not necessary. It's just reasonable to take a supplementary amount on the order of 5,000 units a day. You can adjust it up or down depending upon body weight, but that will get you into the right ballpark for having enough vitamin D on board in your body. It's also a kind of cumulative. It takes a while to be used in the body. So you have to take vitamin D for some weeks before it stabilizes. So no point in measuring it when you first start out.
I also understand that it may deplete magnesium levels, so it's not a bad idea to take magnesium. I've also noticed that some physicians are talking about vitamin K supplementation. Maybe they're worried about vascular calcification or something like that. I don't know.
Or clotting issues.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're back again at commercial break time, so we'll pause for the moment and come back soon. Thanks.
Here we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. AmericaOutloud.com. 7 amazing years. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Cold and flu season is here. Wouldn't it be great if you had a way to minimize airborne viral threats? Well, now there is, and it's a povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray called Cofix RX. You might even say it's just what the doctor ordered. To reduce your chance of getting hurt, you wear a safety belt when you're driving. To limit sun damage, you wear sunscreen on the beach. Cofix RX is just like that. It's an additional layer of protection. It's sold by thousands of pharmacists and medical doctors nationwide. It's made right here in the USA. Again, it's a povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray. You've heard them talk about it here on the Out Loud Network over and over again. Check out CofixRx.com. That's CofixRx.com for a retailer near you, or use coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off at CofixRx.com.
Maintaining a strong immune system has never been more critical. Nutrition company Healthy Cell created Immune Super Boost to help you strengthen your immunity. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Immune Super Boost is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed nutrients proven to support immunity, like vitamin C, D3, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
So that was good. That was right on the dot.
Perfect. Perfect.
Okay. Are we ready to start a new topic?
Sure. Let me think here.
I'll start again. So welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Dr. Howard Tenenbaum.
So another few questions to add. We've all been told about the new booster vaccines, the ones tested in eight consenting mice, I believe. So at least that was done right. I understand all the mice were, they had, I guess maybe they had four control and four vaccinated mice, or were they all eight vaccinated? But I understand that the vaccinated mice got sick.
I think all eight mice died.
They all died. And so that doesn't say too much about the bivalent vaccine, but there's even more about the bivalent vaccine that I worry about. One is the fact that it's not actually bivalent, is it? It's more than bivalent in a way.
Well, the spike protein on the virus is composed of, I believe it's three segments. All of them are the same. It's just like it's formed of three of the same parts in a tripod or something like that. And in the vaccine, you have tripods of the booster, bivalent booster, you have tripods of the aimed at the BA4 and BA5 variants, and you have tripods arranged at the original Wuhan strain of the virus. And so the question I think you're asking is it possible that some of those tripods will split up and interchange their segments so that you could have two of one and one on the other on a, you know, and so on, as well as three and zero and zero and three. And that's all possible. I'm not sure that that matters to the immune system so much, but it may be possible.
Yeah, it may not matter much to the immune system, but you know, anytime, I mean, even if somebody just takes an old drug and modifies it with, you know, adding a carboxyl, like a, you know, a couple of atoms to it, they have to go through all sorts of safety testing. And here we, who knows what the safety effects, let's say, of these, I mean, I call them Franken proteins. I mean, what might they do? We don't know.
Well, this is an emergency. We don't have to do safety testing.
Oh, right. I forgot. But of course, even with this relatively small number of bivalent vaccines they've given, isn't there now a signal for, I like how they use the word signal, as if it was something benign, but a signal for injury, particularly a stroke in people, I guess, 65 and up already?
There's the myocarditis and pericarditis signals have been around for a while. The stroke signal came about because the vaccine, forgot the name, the VSD network that right. CDC created to enroll vaccinated people through a cell phone app for them to report adverse signs and symptoms.
Not to get into Canada.
No, not to get into Canada. They were collecting data from that. It was a large number of people. And so people started reporting, or their relatives reported for them, these strokes that had occurred. Now, the interesting thing about this is that CDC said they're only seeing it in one of their monitoring systems, this data link system. They're not seeing it in databases comprised of information from large medical insurance carriers, where comparable information about vaccine usage and various kinds of health outcomes are recorded for insurance purposes. And so the CDC has had access to, I think, six or seven of these large insurance company databases, and they have not made any of that information public. They said in approximately November of 2020 that the CDC was going to monitor adverse events in seven or eight of these large databases, including VAERS and these other databases, for adverse event signals. And then they never talked about anything except VAERS. They described VAERS as being unquantitative, meaning since you don't know how many people are out there, only the ones who self-report, you don't really know the rates, the risks of these events. You only know the numbers of events, so you can't really calculate the probabilities from them. So it can't be used for measures. And they never said anything else about any of the other data from any of their other sources that they supposedly were monitoring and had promised to report from. However, when this one signal became readily apparent and got leaked from the CDC about the strokes that they were observing, then suddenly the CDC opened up all their information from all their other databases to say, we don't see this same signal in all these other databases. So for them, it was convenient that when they wanted to show that something wasn't real, they opened up all their other databases to claim that it didn't exist there. And when a signal is one that they didn't want to release at all because it was there, then they clamped down and didn't release any information from any of their other databases. So that's a game. That's a paternal game, paternalistic game that CDC has been playing, saying, we know better than you how to interpret science. We know better than you what you should do for yourself. We know better than you whether you should be mandated to take these vaccines and so on, because we're the government.
So I'm presuming they use the Medicare, Medicaid databases, yes, or don't use them or whatever,
yes,
as well. So that, so you know, clearly, in since the booster, they started noticing this booster-associated stroke signal. But of course, if it's a fatal stroke, you're not going to see much medical care, very many medical care codes used.
Well, no, but still, it gets recorded. These things get recorded. Vaccination status gets recorded, although in the Epic medical record system that many hospitals use, the recording of vaccination status is strange. If somebody got vaccinated in the hospital where the records are at, so they went back to the same hospital for care that they got vaccinated in, then the box will be checked saying that they were vaccinated. However, if they got vaccinated somewhere else, that box will not be checked. And so the hospital will consider them unvaccinated. And the only way to know is to look in the text fields in the records where people have handwritten in or hand typed in information about the patient that says that the patient was vaccinated. But that information does not get into the hospital records. And so people get misclassified as to their vaccination status in numbers of the studies that have been published in the U.S. anyway, where this record system has been used.
And it kind of explains the pandemic of the unvaccinated in part. I mean, there's the initial, this is one of my favorite, where they literally used unvaccinated individuals as part of the database, derived from a time when the vaccine wasn't even available yet, but also this issue of unvaccinated or non-vaccinated individuals presenting to hospital with disease. Well, they probably are vaccinated.
Well, they were not recognized as vaccinated. And don't forget, the other thing is that the virus has changed over time dramatically with the five major waves that we've experienced in the U.S. and North America, that the virus has changed, its aggressiveness has changed, its transmissibility has changed. And so you can't compare outcomes of people in the first wave with the original Wuhan variant or closely related strains to people later on in the B2 and Delta and the other strains, and use one as a control group for the other, because the disease caused by the virus is different.
Yeah. And I mean, this also gets to something related now, more not so much to the immunity side, but to the adverse outcome side, where or adverse event side, where you're unvaccinated if it's not recorded, if you weren't vaccinated in the hospital, but also you're unvaccinated or non-vaccinated until 2 weeks after you've received your second shot, which to me is gaslighting cubed, if you will.
Correct. I mean, I think this was a trick that, in doing randomized controlled trials, there's two criteria for efficacy or efficaciousness. One is the theoretical best that the agent could do. So if an agent takes 2 weeks before it becomes effective, then the best it could do is, that it's not going to be effective in the first 2 weeks. So you omit that. You omit that from everybody. You omit the first 2 weeks from the placebo people too. And so you compare only after 2 weeks to see how the drug does. And as opposed to, you're vaccinated or you're treated as soon as you make plans to go get whatever it is you're going to get. So if you get into a car accident and you're on the treatment arm, that counts.
All right.
On the way to the hospital.
In Canada.
Right.
You know about the data in Canada.
No, but it wouldn't surprise me. But anyway.
Yeah, the Canadian data show that if you're unvaccinated, you're more likely to be involved in a car accident.
Oh, yes. Yes. Right. Well, that's another commentary. But the point is, this is only a reasoning system for vaccine effectiveness, efficacy. It is not a reasoning system for harm. Vaccine harm occurs the minute you being facetious or when the needle plunges into your arm.
Or the risk for it.
The risk for hazard. Yeah. There is no question whatsoever that vaccine risk starts as soon as the needle enters your arm. And so studies that pretended that people weren't vaccinated until 2 weeks later, and therefore adverse events aren't gathered until 2 weeks, it's bizarre and absurd. And if you look in the VAERS, you'll see the very large proportion of adverse events that are reported on the day of vaccination, the next day, or the day after that.
Yeah, even there's a group, React 19, I think they've got about 20,000 members, sadly. These are people who've suffered vaccine injury. 90% of their injury developed within the day of to 3 days, 1 to 3 days post-vaccination, which to me raises another question. We focus on the spike protein, and I think there's data to indicate that it is a toxic protein. We know on the basis of many studies that it has various toxicities. But I don't think that the early toxicities that we see following injection, let's say, if we don't use the word vaccination, is from the mRNA. What do you think?
You think that it could be from the lipid nanoparticles,
right?
It could very well be. I think that when you inject things for vaccination, that there's, if you do it properly, meaning you insert the needle, you pull back on the plunger to see if there's if you're in the bloodstream. So if you check to see if there's blood that comes into the syringe. If there's no blood, then you push the syringe in slowly so that you don't get it into the bloodstream. If you do it that way, there's a 2% chance. I've seen a paper that studied this, a 2% chance that some of the vaccine contents will get into the bloodstream anyway. If all you do is you push in the needle and then you push the plunger and you don't check for being in the bloodstream, there's a 5% chance that vaccine will get into the bloodstream. So there, what you have is the immediate exposure in, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people in a large population of the 2% or 5% level of people whose bloodstreams have been exposed to the spike protein, you know, through
the LNPs.
Well, the lipid nanoparticles, but that get into the cells lining the arteries and veins and replicate the spike protein, which comes out and is expressed on the surface of all the blood vessel cells. And that process probably takes on the order of a day, 2 days, 3 days for that to happen. So that is an immediate effect, and it's possible the lipid nanoparticles can pass the blood-brain barrier. They can get into the brain, and they get into cells because the membrane of the particle fuses with the cell membrane and opens up and just dumps the contents into the inside of the cell, because cells themselves are made up of lipid bilayers. So, and that's the same kind of membrane that the vaccines are made in. So there's always that risk. This also raises the question about the new generation of mRNA vaccines using the nucleocapsid antigen, which is another surface protein, an immunogenic surface protein of the COVID virus that mutates less, whether that will still have some of the same toxic effects as the current generations. And because it's a lipid nanoparticle, it probably will. Because it gets into the circulation to the same degree, because of the injection technique, it probably will. It may not be quite as bad as what we've seen, but there's no reason to think that it will be a safe process, that the whole idea of having your cells make the antigens for the immune system to be exposed to make the antibodies is a bad idea, because it isn't just that the cells make the antigens because of the mRNA and release it into the bloodstream for the immune system to see. The cells of your body make these antigens and tack them onto the outsides of the cells. And so the immune system thinks that these cells, your normal cells of your body that are making these antigens, are foreign invaders. And so the immune system goes and attacks your cells that are making this foreign immune product that stimulates the body's immune system. And so because of that, there's a big risk of creating inflammation on the linings of blood vessels in every organ where these things go. So if it's the heart, the brain, the kidney, the ovaries, the testes, and so on, everywhere that this vaccine goes and invades the cells to make the antigens from the mRNA coating does potential damage to the cells in that organ because of the immune system, because of the blood vessels becoming inflamed from the immune response, because the immune system is attacking them. So I'm not optimistic that any of these mRNA vaccines are going to succeed as is being recognized. And the evidence for this is the increasing evidence of higher all-cause mortality across multiple countries, across multiple insurers, in the working age, 18 to 64 age group, that occurred starting in the second half of 2021 and going into early 2022 during, about 6 to 9 months after the vaccine rollouts, at a time when people have gotten the vaccines and adjusted to them in some kind of steady state way over time. And then this inflammation of all these organs has had a chance to grow and create an inflamed tissue that reduces the ability of the organ to function well or properly or safely. And I think that's what's been going on.
Right. And that's not in and of itself autoimmunity. That's just an immune reaction against cells that are expressing a foreign protein.
Right.
And that's that's the danger, with nuclear capsid.
That's right. Well, yeah, as it turns out, we're out of time already. This hour has 54 minutes has really flown by. So I hope everybody's enjoyed our discussion. And if you have questions, I'm reminding you to submit them at americaoutloud.com/pulse. So Howard, thank you so much. It's been a really great discussion and I've enjoyed it a lot. And thanks everybody for listening. Please come back next week.